Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for TWiT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Live Special number 122, live from NAB 2012, recorded Thursday, April 19th, 2012. This episode of TWiT Live is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code NAB4. And by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker who needs stock video clips, photos, illustrations, music tracks, or sound effects, check out Pond5 for instant downloads at the best prices anywhere. And for 50 files absolutely free through May 31st, go to www.pond5.com/twit. I want to welcome everybody to the final day of coverage from TWiT over the NAB 2012 National Association of Broadcasters show. We've had a wonderful 4 days here of running around and interviewing a bunch of people and seeing a bunch of incredible stuff, really pointing the way toward the future of not only broadcasting but content creation. Leo made this point earlier in the show that he heard something like 25% of the attendees here are broadcasters. And we see a lot of technology for movie making and all sorts of other content creation. So perhaps we should rename the show National Association of Content Creators, or NAC. In any event, we do have a couple more hours to go here on the show floor, here at the TWiT stage in our lovely skybox overlooking the South Hall, where there are all sorts of interesting demos. I went to some yesterday, and I'll tell you about those a little later. But right now, we've got a couple of guests, Richard Rary and Sam Goldman of NPR Labs, which is associated with National Public Radio, right?
Right. It's a small unit in the distribution division of NPR, the NPR corporate. Mm-hmm. In Washington, D.C. I mean, it's a very small unit.
This is half the unit right here?
We're right there.
50%
right
of us.
Okay, and what do you guys do in the lab?
Well, we work on a variety of things. We work on accessible radio. We work on HD radio issues, RF propagation. I think some web interface stuff.
Well, and as we've seen here at the show, one of the themes is the evolving nature of broadcasting and how it's now kind of two-way street. We've seen it here with the chat room.
Absolutely.
And with social media. There's a lot of opportunity for much more audience interaction than there used to be. And you guys are right at the forefront of that. Another thing you guys are doing that I heard about earlier is some new technologies for accessibility of radio to those with hearing with hearing impairment.
It's also for not only for the deaf, but the deafblind. Mm-hmm. It's bringing radio to people that want to consume it but can't because it's just not accessible. Mm-hmm. So we're using some speech-to-text technology that is now affordable and somewhat computerized. It can be cleaned up.
Is that getting more accurate than it used to be? I mean, speech-to-text has been around for a long time.
But it's very, very difficult unless your computer is trained to your voice. Mm-hmm. And probably the most accurate was a $120 an hour stenographer, which is beyond the reach of radio.
That is the problem.
So that's bringing technology to bear to bring that technology. And once you get the program into text, it can be sent to a refreshable brailler, and it can be read by a deafblind person as well. So
is so cool. It actually has little pins that raise and lower, and
8 pins that are on a little solenoid, and there's a little cantilever. So no matter how hard they read, it won't damage the mechanism. But it's hideously expensive. Mm. It's technology that is $100 per braille character.
Wow.
And
so it's for the rich deafblind.
It should be for everybody.
Of course.
Yeah, there are programs that fund braille displays. But yes, essentially, they are extremely expensive and not necessarily accessible.
Yeah.
Accessibility devices.
But the cool part is there's an audience waiting to be served that is hungry for the information. And we have anecdotal stories of professors at Gallaudet who have married, who are deaf and have married a hearing spouse,
mm-hmm.
and are irritated because they can't get the transcripts for NPR programs for 3 days because of the process to get the accuracy.
Right, of course.
And by that time, all of their hearing friends have discussed the programs, and they're annoyed because they can't be a part of it.
And it's old news.
Yes.
In a sense.
Yes. So we're very much looking forward to opening accessibility to everybody that wants it, and suddenly there's just hundreds of thousands of people that could benefit from this.
Wow.
The other anecdote we get is people are in the car. There's a couple. Mm. One is driving, can't sign while your hands are on the wheel, and
right.
they're listening to Car Talk, laughing hysterically while the spouse is sitting in the other seat.
Yes,
I don't know what's going on.
I can't hear it.
Yeah, yeah.
This might be inappropriate. I don't know if my husband should be listening to it.
Wow. Well, that's very cool. Car Talk is one of my favorite shows, by the way. So, well, that's fantastic. I'm really glad to know that that you're working on widening the availability of NPR programming to those who might not otherwise be able to enjoy it.
The cool part is using HD radio technology. It's the national digital standard now, mm-hmm. for the United States. It's closer to being just an open pipe, and you can fill it with data or audio or picture or anything you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's been always the problem of getting more receivers out into the marketplace for more
sure.
people to receive it and
sure.
having receivers. My goal, my secret dream is having a receiver that has an API so y'all out there could put your work into a receiver and make it do whatever you want it to do to display however you want it. I think that would be the ultimate, just like we do with web interfaces and have the look and feel.
Sure.
We're hopefully one step closer to that this year. Ubiquiti has developed a phone which has an HD radio, not just an FM radio, but an HD radio chip inside. So that, it's an Android phone and it's a prototype so they can go and try and market this to people.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we'll have HD radios and cell phones pretty soon.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of bandwidth do you get with HD radio? I mean, per channel, I guess. How much is there?
Well, the total bandwidth is 120 kilobits per second on the... there are actually a couple different logical channels. So the main one, you get 120, and then you can get an additional 24 on a second without... going all digital, which is currently not authorized by the FCC, but
mm-hmm.
perhaps way down the road could be. But yeah, currently with the hybrid broadcast, you get 120 and then 24 on the second. The 120 can be subdivided into whatever data and audio channels you'd like to.
So that 120 carries the audio plus whatever data you want.
Yeah, you can divide. You can decide the bit rate of your audio channels, and you can assign certain bit rates for data channels, for album art, for text,
mm-hmm.
for captioning in our case is very interesting. We'll be starting to work with that. And it's totally dynamic. So you can change it, and there's no difference in the carrier. Nothing goes off. The receivers automatically know. And I think the technology is so intriguing that it uses some military communications technology, and it has 1,024 digital carriers superimposed on an FM channel. And I think if more people, more techies like us, could look into it. I mean, there's some books by David Maxon about HD radio. You would go, wow, this is mind-blowing, the kind of error correction and data correction
mm-hmm.
and ability to receive the data signals under less than optimal conditions. It's very elegant. It's extremely elegant.
Wow. Well, again, another example of the changing face of broadcasting.
Yes.
You know?
Well, actually, yes, and it just makes broadcasters more comfortable to transition into the IT and technology world. It's so logical. It's just an even flow. So you learn it here. Hey, it works over here as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for stopping by.
Yeah,
we really appreciate it.
On.
Richard Rary and Sam Goldman of mm-hmm. NPR Labs giving us a glimpse into the future of what we might expect from NPR and others ultimately down the line.
Absolutely. Perfect. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay, I think we have Alex out in the field at Canon, one of the most interesting demos I saw here at the show. And so let's see what he found there at the Canon booth.
Hey, this is Alex Lindsay with Darren Okada, and we are here with the Canon C500. So have you gotten a chance to play with this at all?
I haven't had a chance to play with this yet, but I did see the screening of the 4K images, and it was pretty stunning for the size camera it was. I mean, it's supposed to be like a $30,000 body.
Which is quite an amazing thing when you think about it. A couple years ago, people were asking, when Red came out with it, of course, what do you need 4K for? Now we're looking at a 4K camera from Canon at less or $30,000 roughly for the body.
Roughly, yeah. It's pretty amazing. I mean, it's laid out very neatly. It's small. It takes these cine lenses that they're building. But when I got to the screening, I had a little trouble finding the theater. And I ended up in the third row and thought I was going to be really upset, and was not. I was sitting in the third row watching these 4K images out of the camera, and it was truly amazing looking.
Does it feel like film when you're looking at it?
It does. I mean, it feels closer to film than I've seen other cameras that started out, I mean, of this sort of size.
Right, right. And it is amazing when you really think about not only the fact that it's shooting 4K, but the form factor is so small. I mean, it really is getting to this tiny little camera. Because they're really, you know, we're focused now on, we don't have the tape transports. We don't have a lot of the boards, you know, that were required before. And so we're really getting down to the sensor and making it just small enough where you can still fit all your connections and all the pieces out to make it work.
I mean, one of the things, I mean, this is the same form factor as the C300 that they introduced just in November, last November. But there's something about the size of this where it feels like it wants to be right in your hand. I mean, on this side's usually a grip, but because of the 4K outputs here, they're using this as an output port. But you could take this and just do, you know, work with it like it's a Hasselblad, or build it out like this in a full studio mode, which is a really cool, versatile camera.
Now, still, there's a lot of content that's still being shot on film. When does it get to a point where it just doesn't make sense anymore? When you start seeing this stuff at this price point, with this kind of feature set, when do you think that it becomes really difficult to justify film production?
Well, the price point for the camera is very aggressive. I think that when the price comes down to store the footage, because you can shoot the stuff. But to store this many terabytes is actually starting to creep back up and even up the field. So I think once that whole technology starts to come down, then it's just going to be irresistible.
Well, that's that constant challenge, right?
Right.
Every time the storage gets faster and cheaper and everything else, then suddenly we just learn how to use it all up. It's that no matter how big your backpack is,
exactly,
it's always full.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's do you think you're going to have a project that you're going to possibly use one of these on?
I think definitely. I mean, I've seen the low light capability of this. The dynamic range is incredible, and it has, using the Canon log, gives you so much more range to correct from. You can actually paint the image you want in it. It's really close to the same working method as transferring film to a digital intermediate. So you get a lot of those tools back that you can use.
Fantastic. Well, that is the Canon C500. Darren, thanks so much.
Hey, my pleasure.
This is Alex Lindsay and Darren Okada at NAB 2012.
Thanks, Alex. Yeah, that's an amazing camera, I have to say. I got here early on Sunday, earlier than I might have otherwise, in order to see specifically the short movies. They're still called films. I'm not quite sure why. I guess out of tradition. That Canon shot with the C500. One of them was with the C500. The other one was with the EOS 1DC, which is essentially a digital SLR with 4K video capability. And both of those films are remarkable. And in particular, the C500 was a movie called Man and Beast. And it was both of them are about 8 minutes long. And it's a documentary about a biologist by the name of Rabinowitz, that's right, Alan Rabinowitz, who was born a severe stutterer. And he found that he could not speak to people, but he could speak to animals. Fascinating story. And he ended up learning how to speak. And in fact, he did the voiceover of the movie, and it was perfectly fluent. So this was quite remarkable. But in terms of the technology and the movie itself, shot at 4K, shown at a theater here in Las Vegas over at the Palms Hotel on a 50-foot screen at 4K from a Sony 4K projector.
It just looked amazing. There were some close-up shots of jaguars. He has become a specialist in jaguars and tigers. And some of the shots of these tigers and jaguars in particular were just incredible, with the detail in the hair and the whiskers and so on. It really is something special. Somebody in the chat room was asking about the lenses. The body of that camera, the C500 that Alex was showing us, is about $30,000 roughly. And the lenses, of course, vary greatly in price depending upon, you know, what it is. I will say that the movie that I saw shot on the C500 was quite remarkable. One aspect of it that was really remarkable, other than the great resolution, was the low light capability. There was a shot in particular of Alan Rabinowitz as a boy walking along down a hallway. And it was just natural light, and his face was going from shadow to a little bit of light to more shadow to a little bit of light, back and forth. And the camera just caught it, and the shadow detail was wonderful. You could see, even in the darkest moments, how things were really looking. It didn't get lost in this fog, so it was a remarkable thing. The other movie was shot on this digital SLR, EOS 1DC, also looked great. The 1DC can only shoot at 4K at 24 frames per second. The 500 can shoot up to 60, I think, or even 120. But even at 24, the 1DC looked fabulous as well. And that thing is so small and portable. They did a little behind-the-scenes thing that was really great, because there's one shot where this couple, the main characters in the movie, are running down a flight of stairs to run out of a store. They've just put on some clothes, and they're stealing them. That's neither here nor there. What's important is, what I found fascinating was that the main director of photography was shooting them with this camera. He got to the railing where the stairs started, and handed the camera off to his assistant, who then followed them down the stairs, and it was at one unbroken shot. And this was made possible by the fact that this camera is so small. And also in 4K, and it also looks fabulous. I don't think it has quite the same dynamic range as the 500, but, you know, that thing, the body is $15,000, half the price of the C500. And it'll accept all the same lenses. So, you know, it is a brave new world for cinematography, for movie making, as well as for broadcasting. I think we have Kirk in the field with his own company, Telos, and he's going to tell us a little bit about what they're doing.
Hey, it's Kirk Harnack live at NAB 2012, and we're in the Telos Omnia Axia booth, I guess really now known as the Telos Alliance. That's what my paycheck says on it. So we were interviewing folks that I work with every day. This is cool. We're with Joe Talbot. Hey, Joe, how are you?
I'm great. Great. It's good. Good.
You are the Telos product manager, and you are also an expert at what? SIP telephony.
Right.
Yeah. Well, tell us what SIP telephony is meaning for broadcasters.
Well, flexibility is incredible. You can do anything you want with phones now. The audio quality is better. We can do things like G722 on a telephone, so it doesn't sound like a telephone anymore. It doesn't have that kind of, you know, sound.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. But some people are calling that HD voice.
They are.
Which, for telephone companies, it's a big improvement.
Well, for those of us who are broadcasting now, HD, I don't know, 7 kilohertz, is that really HD? Yeah. But comparatively, it's great.
It sounds great for telephone. So tell me what we're looking at. Right, we got a little console here, a little Axia console. Well, let's look at the phone. How about that?
Yeah, that's great.
All right, tell us what we're looking at here.
Okay, it's a 12-line phone. It's the VSET 12. Completely flexible. I can push a button here and completely change the lines that are on it. Now that's a single, this is a production room show that I defined, but if you had a studio that's used for multiple shows, different kind of things, needed different phone numbers, you could easily go in here and change this to something else.
And this phone is connecting to a server, sort of.
Correct.
What's that?
To what we call the VX engine. And the VX engine with over Ethernet, powered over Ethernet.
Wait a minute, I gotta see.
You gonna show the back of it here?
Yeah, let me show the back there.
Yeah, they made the cord short.
Oh, the cord short. Okay.
There we go.
All right, it's an Ethernet jack with the lights and everything.
Regular old Ethernet. So basically that talks to an engine which is in the rack over here. Typically you'd have that in the back of the radio station someplace.
Let's take a walk over there. We have some more phones that attach to the system right here.
Not everybody needs a 12-line phone, so we have a 6-line phone and a single-line phone. That'd be good for like production rooms or news workstations, something like that.
And all of these connect via just Ethernet to a switch,
exactly,
which is hooked to the engine.
Exactly right.
Okay.
Here's the VX engine right here.
All righty.
And it's a pretty simple device. It's got dual power supplies in case, you know, one fails, but it also has just two Ethernet jacks on the back. That's all there is. So one of them, pretty much the lines go in as SIP, and the other one is talking to the whole LiveWire ecosystem.
So this is, if I get it right, this is a multi-studio, multi-line phone system working with SIP trunks.
Correct.
And you can move things around. If you got a morning show that, oh my gosh, we're doing a big contest today, need more lines.
Sure. If you have exactly. If they had a talk show or just a request show, they might need more lines or less lines of another type. But the main thing is the audio quality on this will blow you away. It's like nothing you've ever heard on the phone.
I understand that this is on the air now at some big TV news
right network. People you've heard and know, and yeah.
All right.
Good outfit.
Thanks a lot, Joe. Appreciate it very much. Sure. We're walking on through the Telos Omni and Axia booth here. So that's a little bit busy. There's a whole rack of telephone hybrids over here, single-line hybrids, multi-line talk show systems, a bit more traditional in the Axie, or in the Telos line. We're going to make our way over now to the Omnia stand, and standing by in the Omnia stand is my friend Corny Gould. Hey, Corny.
Hey.
How you doing, man?
All right, how you doing?
Good to see you. You've been showing folks a processor that was introduced a couple of years ago, and shipping, we got some new software we're shipping now for it, right? Tell us about it.
Yes, on the Omni 11, we have version 1.1 software, which we're now shipping out to folks. And we bring out a number of new features in the Omni 11 for the users. In our advanced menus, we bring out some controls to help you fine-tune our wideband AGC to your programming more. Controls to manipulate the gate, control the ratio. And, you know, so we have a lot of little controls like that, but one of our nice, neat features that we've brought out now is a 3-band parametric equalizer, so that allows you to fine-tune your low end even further. That's been the most exciting thing, and, as well as a new clipper.
Oh, that Frank mentioned that on the on the Torch show this week.
Yes.
One of the things that, the thing that sets the Omni 11 technology apart from others, I've heard engineers say, Corny, it sounds effortlessly loud. What does an engineer mean when he says it sounds effortlessly loud?
It could be loud without sounding like you're pushing the processor to sound loud, you know.
So it sounds much more natural than previous technologies.
Yes. Yes, it sounds, for the given loudness level, there's a certain relaxed, you know, laid back effort. Sort of like a strong guy just lifting up a heavy suitcase without thinking about
it. How does distortion and getting rid of intermod distortion play into that concept?
A lot of the sound that people equate to is the processor sounding is sounding like it's being louder is the increase of intermod distortion and harmonic distortion. When you remove those, you can be just as loud without that side effect of sounding like you're making the processor be loud.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of folks know what intermod distortion sounds like. They just don't know what it's called.
Right.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Corny.
No problem.
Appreciate your time very much. We're going to make our way over now to some of my friends in the Axia department. Let's see where we're headed to. Clark. Hey, Clark.
Hey, Kirk.
How you doing?
Good, man. How
Clark,
you?
Clark Novak is the marketing director, e-marketing for Axia. I guess we ought to go over to the console, shouldn't we?
That'd be a good thing.
Okay, let's run over here. This console looks like something we call the IQ.
Yes, it is. That's because it's smart.
Okay. Tell me about the IQ. This one's kind of big.
Yeah, this comes in sizes from 8 to 24 faders. And what you do is you start with the mainframe, which is 8 faders wide, and then you can add on additional modules that allow you to construct customized consoles. For instance, this one over here has 6 additional faders, and it also has these user buttons on the side that let you connect to GPIO events or routing commands, customize some things for control of your peripherals around the studio. This one over here has 6 faders, but it also has this interesting little goodie here in the center, which is control. It's called a console controller, and that hooks right into Telos new generation phone systems like the IQ6 or the VX and things that are controlled by VoIP and audio over IP.
Now, a couple of days ago, it was announced that Axia's LiveWire technology would be compatible, or is now compatible apparently, with the European-based standard Ravenna.
Well,
what can you tell us about this collaboration between the two companies and standards?
Well, it's pretty interesting, Kirk. Ravenna is newer than LiveWire, which is the standard that Axia introduced back in 2003. But what they did was they since they started a little bit later, they were able to take advantage of some of the newer technologies and standards that have become available since LiveWire was introduced.
One called, I believe, IEEE 1588.
1588, right. So that's the IEEE standard for clock. When we invented LiveWire, such a standard didn't exist, so we basically had to write our own. Now there is that standard, and so we started talking with Ravenna and the folks at ALC Networks about a year ago and said, you know, what you're doing and what we're doing is very similar, and it would make more sense for us to collaborate and work together than it would for us to butt our heads together.
Yeah.
And so that's what we've done. So Axia Devices, as you say, right now, using a new product we've introduced right here at the show called an X-Node, are compatible with Ravenna. And going forward, even all of our older product, we're going right back to the beginning in 2003, is going to have a Ravenna compatible mode that will allow them to operate with Ravenna.
Cool. Thanks a lot very much. Appreciate your help, Clark. We've been live here at the Telos Omnia Axia booth at NAB 2012.
I would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this show, Squarespace.com. Now, if you've ever had any inkling to start your own website, and who hasn't, Squarespace.com is a great place to set it up because they offer you all sorts of templates, make it super easy to set up just about any kind of website you'd like with social media features, blog interfaces, and as I said, lots of different kinds of templates. Makes it super simple to start your website with forms, Flickr photo displays, all sorts of stuff. Even better, you can try it for free by going to squarespace.com and using the promo code NAB4. So I sure do encourage you to do that because if you've got a business or if you've got something to say to the world, there's no better way to do it than on a website, and there's no better way to establish a website than at squarespace.com, and use that promo code NAB4 for your free trial. So joining me now are Sean Kilbride and Mark Priscaro of NVIDIA, and you guys, your company is big into computer graphics, so what are you showing us here at the show?
So, you know, we're working with a lot of our partners here at the show. Some of the things that we're really excited about this year at NAB 2012 is the new Mercury playback stuff in Adobe CS6 and how they're utilizing NVIDIA GPUs to really accelerate people's workflows who are using the entire range of suites. You know, in the past, we've worked with Adobe in Premiere on the Mercury playback engine. Now they've expanded the offerings and how the GPU can actually help users into other products like Adobe After Effects as well with the new Optics Ray Tracer that utilizes GPUs,
mm-hmm.
And new accelerated GPU features in Photoshop as well. And you know, SpeedGrade is now shipping as part of the suite, utilizing NVIDIA GPUs to accelerate that and using Quadro SDI for color monitoring. So that we're really excited to be a partner with them this year.
And you mentioned computer graphics at the top, and obviously that's the hallmark of NVIDIA and, mm-hmm. and our product portfolio, but it's so much more now, especially in respect to NAB
mm-hmm.
and broadcasting
mm-hmm.
and post-production. Our overall theme for the show is we're transforming the entire digital content creation workflow. And the way we're doing that is GPU computing is becoming more and more pervasive, especially in broadcast, film, post-production. And here at the show, that's very representative. If you look across some of our major partners across the show floor, I like to say from A to Q, AJA
uh-huh.
systems right. all the way to Quantel,
uh-huh.
You will see our technology incorporated in some form or another in their solutions. In the case of Quantel, their Pablo color correction software. It utilizes GPU acceleration to a large extent. Blackmagic Design, which mm-hmm. is right behind us here with a huge booth, their Resolve, DaVinci Resolve, also uses our technology. Harris with their CG, their Inscriber CG
mm-hmm.
Products, that utilizes a couple of our Quadro professional GPUs, and the list goes on and on. Over 40 partners alone here at NAB.
Well, it seems to me even more important, it's becoming more and more important to have GPU, graphics processing unit, a separate processor dedicated to graphics as high definition becomes the norm as it is now, even as we move into 4K. The amount of data that is having to be run through these systems is just enormous. And so the as much help as they can get, I'm sure, is of great benefit to the workflow, as you say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. Having a dedicated GPU in your system is probably one of the best ways that you can accelerate your workflow in many of the video production applications. And, you know, in addition to just having a GPU, now we're also offering what we call Maximus configurations. As more and more applications take advantage of the GPU processing powers to do basically non-graphical things, they're basically using CUDA, which is our programming language, mm-hmm. to offload a lot of the parallel processing that occurs within these applications.
Ah.
Adding a Tesla card, which is one of our dedicated compute cards, along with one of our Quadro professional cards, that's what we call a Maximus configuration,
mm-hmm.
really allows people to do graphics and compute. And it gives them the best of both worlds to really accelerate these workflows.
Wow, that's incredible. Has NVIDIA addressed the 4K issue? Can you deal with 4K files?
We're definitely working with all of the guys out there that are doing 4K. You know, we've worked with Arri. We're working with the Red guys. And we realize Red is going to be a really big part of
really
video.
Big.
Yeah, moving forward.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's really lowering the barriers, too. It's not just studios that are really interested in it. It's pretty much everybody.
Yeah, the price of these cameras is coming down so far. I mean, we've seen the Canon 1DC at 15 right. grand. JVC has a 4K camcorder at like 5 grand. Sony has one, I think, in the 10 grand range. So, you know, I mean, those still sound like a lot of money. But compared to what it was only a year or two ago, it's really opening that market to a lot more people. And a lot more people are going to want to start processing 4K.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And not just 4K, but we're also looking at guys doing multiple streams. I mean, it's very common now that a video shoot that might have had two cameras before, now that's just exponentially exploding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With these small cameras like GoPro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
That are shooting very high quality, and you can put them anywhere. So people really want to utilize multiple streams. We're showing some great examples of multicam editing using Adobe CS6 mm-hmm. in our booth. That's all using the GPU to process all those streams. So that, you know, basically you can process real time and get all your streams, be able to make your edit decisions really easily.
You know something, the next big thing is coming, but it's like, are the tools going to be there
yes.
to implement that technology? In the case of 4K, yeah, we're fully capable and ready to provide the back technology to manipulate 4K video.
What about higher frame rates? I don't know if you've seen the Christie demo. I was incredibly impressed with that. James Cameron showing the benefit of shooting at 48 and even 60 frames per second.
Well, a friend of his, Doug Trumbull, who you may or may not know.
I do.
We had an industry event last night at the Bellagio, and he's talking about doing 120 frames per second. and we're a key partner of his in doing
Good.
That, along with Christie.
Excellent. That was probably the most impressive demo I've seen so far at the show, is that high frame rate and how much clearer motion looks on the screen.
Yeah, he was talking about how current 3D mm-hmm. Films are at very, very reduced light levels, Lamperts.
Yes.
And to him, that's a huge issue. And
yes.
what he's working on as part of his development of 120 frames per second films is much higher Lamperts. Much brighter viewing experience for the viewers. And
yeah.
he thinks that's going to be the next big thing
mm-hmm.
In film. And what was interesting in his presentation last night was he said, you know, with the proliferation of tablets and smartphones and the younger generations are all viewing content on mobile devices,
mm-hmm.
Movie theater box office revenues are down. About the lowest they've been in about 15, 16 years.
Mm.
And he feels that this is what's going to draw people, including younger crowds, back to the movie theater because the experience is so much more immersive
mm-hmm.
And just a much better experience than what's currently out there.
What about 3D? I assume you guys deal with that as well.
Oh, yeah. You know, one of the nice things is we've got a strong background in 3D stereo graphics. We've offered stereo support on our professional cards from the very beginning.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the ability to work in stereo within the application that you're actually, you know, doing your video in is huge and not have to go out to a specialized system to view that. And so the earlier that you can view your stereographic information, you know, even if it's right after shooting, right in the application, means that you can make those edit decisions earlier, determine whether or not the convergence is off and those kind of things.
Yeah.
So being able to have that ability to process that, utilizing your Quadro graphics card. We even have very specialized viewing solution with our 3D Vision Pro solutions that can either be used at a single workstation or great for theater environments and collaborative spaces.
What is this now? I'm not familiar with this one.
So 3D Vision Pro is a 3D viewing solution that we offer.
It's a display? I mean, it's a...
It's designed to work with lots of different displays.
I see.
We can work with Christie, we can work with Barco, anybody that's doing...
Or any of the 3D TVs that are available?
Exactly, the 3D TVs. And it's an active shutter glass solution, which is really good for reducing the eye strain because we work at a very... And we use a RF transmitter rather than the standard IR, which means that if you happen to look away...
Ah, very good. Very good. So syncing the glasses, you don't have to be line of sight looking straight at the display as you do with most... active glasses TVs.
Right.
In large viewing environments like auditoriums or theaters, it's
makes
very
it much, much better. The only problem I see with that is that active glasses typically reduce the amount of light reaching your eye more than passive glasses. But you do get full resolution in each eye.
Right. And, one of the things that NVIDIA's introduced in our 3D solutions is this thing called Light Boost, which helps to boost the gain on the monitors.
Very good.
And it helps to alleviate some of that.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Sean Kilbride and Mark Priscaro, thank you so much for dropping by. We really appreciate the update on NVIDIA.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate
it. Thank you very much. Okay, I think next we have a missive from the field. Alex at the Sony booth. Take it away.
Hey, Alex, what are you looking at over there?
I'm looking at a marvelous image, let me tell you. You have never looked better. Never looked better.
What 4K good?
This 4K is unbelievable. So this is a slightly larger camera than what we've been looking at.
Right,
why don't you come over here and talk to us a little bit about this? So we've got a... Now, we've been looking at a lot of cameras that are really kind of the rebel filmmaker, the less expensive filmmaker, but this is kind of the big boy of the digital cameras right now.
Yeah, this is pretty much what a lot of the cameras are being compared to. I mean, it's
right.
A full 4K camera.
And it's even more than a 4K camera, right?
The sensor is sensing 8K, downsampling the 4K. And
now, why are they doing that?
Oversampling just makes for an incredibly great picture.
Right.
Also, it's putting out a log signal, so it's very, very film-like. I mean, you'll see right here it says S-Log 2398.
Now, and that's going to look, the raw version of that, of course, log, is going to look very washed out.
It'll look very washed out. It's the same idea behind sort of interpositive in film. It's washed out because what it's doing is, in that bandwidth that it can record, it's compressing a lot of information without throwing information away.
Right.
So when you do color correction, you add the contrast back. You do everything to taste how you want.
Well, and that's the big problem oftentimes with digital is that when it's in a linear format, you're gonna end up getting a lot of whites blown out, a lot of other things that you kind of lose quickly. And in a log format, of course, we're going to be able to get a lot of the sky detail back, lot of the whites.
It makes it so that you're getting as much detail as possible so you can orchestrate it later on in post.
Right. And when we were scanning film, we were scanning
same,
in log.
Yeah, same idea scanning film. It goes from the maximum density to the minimum density. This particular camera I've shot with in December, and it's a pretty wonderful camera. I mean, I panned it into the sun, I shot against trees, and it really holds up. I did my best to try to break the imaging, and it really, really stands up well.
Now, the form factor is very much like an F-23 and F-35?
Yeah. Well, I've heard it's a little lighter than an F-35.
Right.
One thing that makes a big difference is the solid-state SR recorder here on the back.
So this whole back piece can actually come off, right? This is just the recorder that's...
Right.
And before it was drive-based.
It was drive-based. It was tape. Which, who knows what tape was.
Yeah.
this recorder actually will record the full 4K raw image right there. So
it's very convenient. And you've got a nice little controller here.
Yeah. It's a familiar layout to that.
This hasn't changed much. This is the same that we saw with the F-23, right. F-35 that we'd seen here. You've got a lot of your controls on the outside here.
Yeah, the menu system actually in this, it's pretty easy how it works. I mean, it's the most intuitive that I've ever seen.
viewfinder menu.
For this style of camera?
Yeah, for this style. I mean, before, like the F35, the menu system was you'd have to run through so many steps. This one, two steps, and you can get anywhere you want.
Right.
But what makes this actually work really well, turn it this way, is the issue with CMOS type chips. This camera took that whole thing, that whole blurry, wobbly, jelly look when you're panning across, and there's an actual mechanical shutter right here.
Wow.
Which is unique to this camera in 4K. The Arri Alexa Studio has a mechanical shutter, but this camera has it built in. It's standard, so you can.
So instead of having the chip actually scanning and doing the refresh for every frame, the chip is grabbing it, and the
shutter's coming down, and it clears the chip, so you'll get a clean exposure of movement, and it looks. I've shot both with and without. And it looks really filmic with the mechanical shutter going. But it was a really simple solution to a pretty complex problem.
Right, and that's not something you're going to see in the lower-end cameras. Or not the lower-end, but the less expensive cameras. Right. This is something that, I mean, because this camera is a little more expensive than all the other ones. I mean, we've been talking about $30,000 and $10,000, but this one is...
But it's still, I think, the body, I believe, is below $70,000.
Is it really?
Yeah.
No.
So for the technology of this.
Really? I thought this one was much higher. I thought this was.
What I've seen is somewhere between $60,000 and $70,000 for the body. No, not the lenses.
Right. Right.
But.
And of course, most people aren't buying these. So what happens most of the time when you're thinking about filmmaking with these digital cameras? Once you get to this size, especially. I always think of when you're in the maybe up to 30,000, but really in the 10 to 20,000, people are buying them and they're using them in internally. Once they get over that's a rental agency.
It is. You know, but at this price, I mean, you're looking at an image that can be blown up on a gigantic 60-foot screen. It may make sense. There may be a lot of sales where, you know, you'd want to own this camera to be able to do things.
You can keep it busy enough.
Yeah.
So anyway, so this is the F65 at the Sony booth. Here at NAB 2012.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. The F65, that's the big guns. As he said in that little piece there, you're probably going to rent that. You're probably not going to buy that, except if you're James Cameron, perhaps. Although I don't know, I'm not saying that he's endorsing that. I don't know what cameras he uses, actually. But that is the big gun at Sony. And Sony was interesting. We passed by their booth. In fact, we did some of Home Theater Geeks there. And they've got a whole range of cameras from that at the top end down to, I forget the model number now, but it's, around $10,000 or less, I think he said, for, again, 4K. So, this to me, this is the show of 4K. We're seeing it everywhere. We're seeing it in cameras. We're seeing it in displays. We're seeing it in workflows just about everywhere. That there's anything here, we're looking at 4K. One of the most interesting 4K developments for me as a home theater geek is the projector and the Red Ray player at Red Digital Cinema. Now, we all know Red as being one of the premier digital camera makers, and a lot of top-name filmmakers are using it. Peter Jackson is using the Red at... filming The Hobbit, which is going to be at a higher frame rate, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But what was really interesting at the Red booth this year is a new projector, and it's a 4K projector. It is modular in that the light source, the illumination source, is in a separate box. And so the projector itself is small and light, and all it has is the what's called the modulation engine or the imaging engine, which produces the image that is then projected onto the screen. And the light that is used to illuminate that image comes from a trio of lasers in a box that sits in a rack someplace and is connected to the projector by fiber optic cable. And what's really cool is that you can stack these laser modules. So depending on the size of the screen you want to illuminate, obviously the bigger the screen, the more light you need. So in a home theater situation, you would only use one of these laser packs or modules. And in a larger screen, as you get larger and larger into commercial cinema and so on, you would add a second, a third, a fourth, as many as you want to increase the total light output, which is a brilliant idea, just absolutely brilliant. The other thing that is, in fact, even more important than the projector, which, as I said, projects 4K, is the Red Ray source device. I guess it's called a Red Ray player, I think is what it is. And it is a hard disk server, essentially. You put content onto this hard disk inside this player, and it plays out 4K. This answers the question, the big question about 4K that has been in my mind up to now, which is, okay, we've got cameras, we've got displays. How are we going to get the content into the home? We can get it into the commercial cinema because we have 4K projectors. Studios are now starting to deliver 4K content to the commercial cinemas. But what about to the home? Blu-ray can't do it. We might need a new form of Blu-ray. And everyone's going to roll their eyes and go, oh, no, another disc format, just what we don't need. And Red-Ray, Red Digital Cinema, has come up with this Red-Ray solution, which is not, it's a physical format, but it's not an optical disc. It's a hard disc. And it can stream 4K to the projector, no problem at all. And so the question then is, how are you going to get the content to this player? Well, it offers several options. You can bring it in on an SD card or a USB drive of some sort. So perhaps in the future, 4K movies will be sold on thumb drives, you know? It could be. Or you could bring it in over this professional link called HD SDI. So I think this is one critical part of the whole move to 4K, which is, how are we going to deliver it? And how are we going to play it at home in particular? And this Red-Ray player is the answer. Now, what about pricing? Well, I've heard some pretty interesting things from the guys at Red. The projector itself with one laser illumination module and a Red-Ray player all together, around 10 grand. Yes, that's a lot of money, but for a 4K projector, oh, and by the way, it does 3D at 4K per eye. What? That's amazing. We saw a demo, in fact. They're showing a film. A lot of companies are doing that. They've shot films specifically to show at NAB, and they shot it on the Red camera, of course. It's a film by Luke Scott, Ridley Scott's son. Ridley is listed as one of the producers of the film. It's a little sci-fi short, kind of a dystopian vision of the future, which is kind of, I guess, like father, like son, huh? And I have to say that the image quality was not quite up to what I would like to see. I was told that it wasn't quite totally tweaked and adjusted, tuned perfectly. We were only seeing 2K per eye, whereas in fact we should be able to see ultimately 4K per eye. It was with passive glasses. The black level wasn't that great. The contrast wasn't that great, but I think in part it was due to the content. It was pretty low dynamic range in a lot of that content, and so it didn't quite pop. But, you know, it was a prototype. It was being tuned. It should look better today than it did yesterday, so, you know, we shall see. But it's a very exciting development, pointing the way toward much higher resolutions in the home. Now I think we have somebody. Oh, I see. Okay, yeah, we're gonna go back to Sony because Alex had so much to look at there that he had yet more. He has more missives from the field. So take it away, Alex.
This is Alex Lindsay and Darren Nakata, and we are here again at the Sony booth.
Yes.
And this is the NEX FS700U, which I think is it's one of the revolutionary things that we're seeing here at the show.
Yeah, this camera does slow motion, incredible slow motion, and it will be. I believe this is going to have a firmware update at some point and a little package that can use its 4K sensor. It actually has a 4K sensor in it.
Right, and so you have the 4K sensor. Now this looks a lot like an FS100, and I have a small collection, a small gaggle of FS100s that we use a lot. We really like them. Interchangeable lenses. You have the, but it pretty much the 100 kind of ends right here, and you've got the lens mount. And there's a whole other section here that is where the 700 probably begins in a lot of ways. Now, and I think that the big thing that we're seeing here is that we haven't seen a low-cost, high-speed camera at a real resolution. Of course, Casio has ones that are like 190, 180 by 20 exactly. or something like that. But we're looking at a like real resolution that you could use in a project at a reasonable price. I mean, I think this is like $10,000.
Yeah, I mean, it's the technology packed in here. Watching the slow motion is absolutely beautiful. It looks like film slow motion. It's just gorgeous.
And we're talking about 480 frames a second at 720p, 240 frames a second at 1080p, and then it's unknown at the higher resolutions that it might be available, what the speed might be. When we were working on films, I mean, really, when you're talking mechanical film, we were talking 320, 240.
Yeah,
I mean, that was pretty
320
much...
320 was where you could go without getting too specialized.
Right.
And at that, all you had was a window of maybe 5 seconds of action that you're going to expand out. I mean, this, you can roll and get... you know, incredible results with it.
Right. Yeah. So the and this one is the one that won the best camcorder of the year here at NAB, and it is, and I can see why. I mean, I think that this changes the game because I think that a lot of other people. Now, of course, Red has been doing it from
right.
day one.
Yeah.
We have to always remind you know, that, I mean, because I still feel like a lot of this revolution is all.
Thanks to
Red.
Yeah, Red drove everybody to want to develop something
right.
smaller, more affordable, and let's push our technology.
I hate to be the old geezer, but I just keep on looking at these little cameras, a $10,000 camera that could shoot 4K, shoots high speed. This is really my next camera that I'm going to buy.
Yeah, I mean, this camera is really exciting. Last year we saw this form factor, and I thought
right. This
was great. But now adding the rest of this and having the high speed, just the high speed alone is cool to get. But now you get an entire camera and someday 4K capable.
Well, and I think that a lot of people sometimes have a hard time thinking about what would you use high speed for other than throwing things on the ground, and which is, by the way, very fun. Throw things on the ground, taking
watch
pictures of
break.
Yeah, watch things break in slow motion, watch water. But, you know, a lot of times in the visual effects area, of course, we're slowing things down to add scale.
Yeah, add mass to it. So we're not dropping a real house. It's a smaller house.
Right, exactly. And there's a whole mathematical equation to how many frames you need
yep.
to, you know, if it's a 1/32nd or 1/12th scale, you know, there's a certain speed that you have to set it up so that it's going to look like it's real.
Right.
And so, and that's the idea that the average consumer, I think this is going to change what we see on YouTube. This is going to change what we see on a lot of other pieces of content. And, of course, I think every camera is going to have this in the next couple of years.
Yeah, slow motion capability is just going to add a whole other visual language to what the average consumer is putting out there. And I think, you know, once you shoot something that's super slow motion, like 200 plus frames, it's addictive. You want to see everything like that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, this is Alex Lindsay and Darren Okada, and this is at the Sony booth here at NAB 2012.
Wow, Sony's just got so much stuff to show. Before we saw, of course, their top of the line, and there we just saw the entry level at $10,000 for a camera that can do 4K when they upgrade the software. So at the moment it doesn't, but it will be able to ultimately. It's got the hardware to do it. And for, you know, 10 grand, that's starting to get into semi-affordable range. Anyway, visiting me now is Alec Pedersen at Wide Orbit. Hey, Alex.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell us about Wide Orbit. What does the company do?
Wide Orbit got in the business about 12 years ago. We started in the traffic and sales systems. And traffic is not managing cars and streetlights.
It's not like, now on the 405, we got to jam up it.
Exactly. Sig alert on the 405.
Sig alert on the 405.
Exactly.
Right.
So not that type of traffic system. It helps.
So what are we talking about traffic? What's the word traffic mean in this case?
Traffic really is inventory. It helps a broadcaster, particularly a television station or cable network, manage their sales, their sales content. It's all about revenue and driving their bottom line.
Of
right?
course.
So they sell spots, manage programs. It helps them to build that inventory list, to optimize their sales, and to really look and drive revenue and optimize that revenue base. So it's a software product. It's not a hardware product. It's a software.
So it runs on Windows or whatever?
It runs on a Windows-based technology, SQL database, MS SQL database.
Mm-hmm.
But it helps them. That's where that's our entry point. That's where we started. We actually have and help sales assistants and executives to sell inventory on their television station. That's our entry point. We've continued to build our product base and provide more technology and more tools across the media landscape to help television stations and cable networks manage their operations. We started And the product that I oversee is the Wide Orbit Master Control and Automation product. And what that means is that we help actually the television station or cable network manage their content, video and audio content. Mm-hmm. Actually, the playout, what a consumer sees on their television set,
right.
That's the product behind the cameras,
right? Right.
Behind the television set is this technology that we deliver that to the television set.
Called management. Automated management.
It's exactly. It's automation, mm-hmm. right? It's master control and automation.
Master control. That's what right, right. reminds me of the master control program in the original Tron.
Yeah. Great. So what we have is a television station. Just kind of walk you through the content or the workflow.
Yeah, please.
The television station will actually receive a commercial, and it could be delivered satellite, could be delivered tape. Over the internet, mm-hmm. it could actually be FTP, right? So mm-hmm. they get that content in. Same thing with the program. So I Love Lucy comes in,
right?
Kind of dating myself.
Yeah,
maybe
well,
American Idol. So American Idol comes in, right? And they have commercial against that, right? They're selling time against that program.
Sure.
Right? That comes in, gets delivered. The television station, cable network, looks at it. They need to manage that. They need to edit it. They need to put that in the right form for playout.
Right.
Be it 1080, 480, 720, whatever that form factor is on the delivery piece.
Right.
They need to put that in the right form.
Right.
So they can deliver.
And then store it someplace.
Exactly.
On a SAN or whatever.
Whatever type of technology they have in terms of storage, be able to store that. And be able to, at the point where they want to play that out,
mm-hmm.
the technology says, okay, I have American Idol starting at 7 p.m. I have this program. It's stored on this disk drive. Go get that, deliver that, and put that on this particular channel. In addition, it may be deliver other content to different channels.
To different channels.
At the same time.
Sure.
And while that program...
Particularly if it's a cable provider.
Absolutely.
You've got hundreds of channels you have to deal with.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is all without human intervention. That's why it's called automation.
Sure.
Okay?
That makes sense.
So then they're playing the content. Now it comes to the commercial break. That commercial maybe start on a different medium, different place, different location. Now it takes that and inserts that, right?
Okay.
In between the program, in between the segments.
Oh, of course. And you can't pre-insert it because there might be different ads for different markets.
Exactly.
There we go.
So okay, now you're starting to talk about targeted marketing.
Right.
So now you start to talk about, okay, well, in Detroit, we're going to actually air this commercial.
Right.
We're in Los Angeles. We have a different commercial.
Right.
Same program.
Right.
Same segment, but
right.
different commercials.
Right. And in some cases, it'll be a national commercial that'll be everywhere.
Could very well be a national or a local.
But your automated system will take care of all of that.
It manages all that content.
Wow.
And I want to mention that we just won an award.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. We won the TV Engineering Star Award
mm-hmm.
for innovative technology. And last year, we won the Pick Hit Award. So 2 years in a row, now we've won an award for our technology.
Fantastic.
Quite proud of it. It's not your traditional master control system.
Mm-hmm.
It's really an IT system, IT-based. So file delivery, it's not your traditional, just, you know, the old school broadcast equipment. We run on traditional IT servers. We manage it. There's no transcoding. We can run multiple channels on a single server. So our solution really is master control in a rack. We can actually run four TV stations on one server.
Wow. And what kind of computing power do you need to do that?
It's just a dual-core processor. So we run like I say, average industry IT server.
Mm-hmm. Wow. This is sure a far cry from the days of tape carts, right? When you had to slip the tape cartridge in for this and then the commercial for that.
Absolutely. And I was around for those days. running through master control. I need that commercial. I need that program.
Right.
Trying to find it. So
what was that movie? Was it Network where the woman was running with the tape?
Absolutely. Exactly. That's exactly right. So and that did happen in those days.
Yeah. No longer.
Not today.
Once again, the changing face of technology of broadcasting. We see it demonstrated here time and again.
So we're really proud. We've had a lot of... last year we debuted it. We really didn't have anybody on our system using our technology. Since last year to today, I have 5 channels that were launched using this. We have network, we have weather, and we have an independent TV station. So I have 5 channels currently on our technology. Immediately after the show, I move into launching 3 additional channels. One's an NBC, one's a CBS, and a CW+. All HD. We can manage standard def and HD on the same technology. So there's no, once you go from standard def to HD, same technology.
Same technology.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on your success and your two awards.
Great. And I do want to mention
that
I can actually manage, I brought my iPad.
Oh, yeah, here it is.
But I can actually manage up to four channels.
From your iPad.
From my iPad. So I can actually manage and remote capability to manage a master control system.
Wow. So. Wow. Well, all you TV station owners out there, take note, because this is an important thing for you guys. It's not something that the consumers generally are aware of, except when it goes wrong.
That's when that... Exactly.
Right. Alec Pedersen, thank you so much.
Great, thank you.
All right, that's Alex Pedersen at Wide Orbit talking about all the back-end stuff that that we consumers of TV are rarely aware of, as I said, except when it goes wrong. And hopefully, with using a product like that from Wide Orbit, it's not going to go wrong. So that's really interesting to hear. It's one of the things I really like about being at NAB. Aside from looking for things that are more directly consumer-related, I personally, being a geek, am very interested in the back-end stuff, the behind-the-scenes stuff. You know, what is the nitty-gritty that makes it all work and that we hopefully are not aware of when we're watching TV? So let's see. I think we have Alex yet again out in the field who is about to tell us something from Red Rock Micro.
This is Alex Lindsay and Darren Akata. We are back, and we're at Red Rock Micro, and this... Oh, I got to have one of these. I've been talking about having a wireless firewall focus for years, but I haven't been able to quite afford it.
Yeah, I mean, usually these systems cost like $30,000 to $50,000. I mean, it's a really precision piece of equipment.
Now, what does a firewall focus do for the viewers?
Well, anybody who's been shooting with one of these DSLRs knows that there's very little depth of field, which is great for a creative intent. But to pull focused, you'd have to grab that and shake the whole camera. So this is awesome, where you can remotely, without moving the camera, have somebody operating it and just ride the focus. So if you're walking towards me, I'll just bring the focus closer. It'll isolate your face, and the background will just go softer. So this is, for the price of this, it's just an incredible piece of machinery. And
now this is like $2,500 for, and you get the micro remote, and this can be either wired, which we have it wired here because there's so much RF in the hall, but it can be wireless, and then this is a micro remote.
That's the receiver here, and then it goes down running power through it to the servo motor.
So this is,
this is the remote, the transmitter. This is the receiver, and then it's wired here to the motor, so it's providing power, and it's also sensing where that motor is. I mean, it's like a motion control rig, except in real time.
So as you turn this, now, one of the things, of course, is that there are, of course, mechanical versions of this that'll hook right onto here, and I think Red Rock Micro actually makes the mechanical versions of this, but the advantage of this, of course, is if you have it on a Steadicam, if you have it on a jib, if you have it on handheld, you're going to need to have somebody else managing that while the camera operator is just worried about framing.
And also, with these kind of cameras, you're going to run and gun with these handles. So as you're running, the last thing you want is somebody here that's going to trip you up. So the focus puller can be here on the side and be just working the focus as you're just hauling through some hallway somewhere.
So I think that, again, now that we finally have an opportunity to have one of these at a price point that all of us can actually, a lot of us can actually afford, I think that this is definitely in the short-term future for my little lab. So this is Alex Lindsay and Darren Akata, and this is Red Rock Micro at NAB 2012.
Thanks, Alex. Yeah, I was watching the chat room during that little segment there, and somebody said, I guess 4K is going to have to be delivered by a hard drive or something. Yeah, that's probably true. Or possibly downloading it, like, overnight, because it's going to take up a ton of storage. Interestingly, I wanted to make this point. When I saw the Canon demo, which was these two little short films, one shot on the C500 and the other shot on the 1DC, they're about 8 minutes long, and they were delivered to the theater on 32 gigabyte thumb drives. That's right. It's amazing. Now, you might think, well, even 8 minutes at 4K, that's got to take up a lot of space. Well, it was the content was in the digital cinema package, or DCP, which encodes the video with a codec called JPEG 2000, which is similar to MPEG or H.264 or MPEG-2, in that it compresses the content, the amount of data, by quite a bit. But JPEG 2000 is the standard codec used for digital cinema in commercial applications. So I found that just absolutely fascinating that they could deliver an 8-minute 4K movie on a 32-gigabyte thumb drive. So somebody had it in their pocket, and they stuck it in the projector, and away they went. And it really looked quite amazing. Another thing, speaking of codecs, I did want to also mention that over at Red Digital Cinema, they are also talking about a new codec that they're using. I don't have my notes with me. I forgot what it was called, but it's a proprietary codec that was allowing them to show 4K 3D at about 15 to 20 megabits per second, which is very, very low. And they claim that when they play it next to uncompressed, that it's visually indistinguishable. Now, I'll be the judge of that for myself, thank you very much. But I hope to go and see that, actually, at some point. They're in Irvine, I believe. So I'm in L.A., too, so it's not that far for me to go visit, and I do intend to do that because I find that to be... I think that Red's doing some amazing things, and even though the demo didn't knock my socks off, it points in a direction that that is very important, and they're doing some amazing, amazing stuff. So, yeah, 3-hour movie in the chat room, Kevin says, is not going to be delivered on a thumb drive. No. That's going to be probably either downloaded from a satellite or delivered, hand-delivered by with an actual hard disk. And for the home, I would think with this Red-Ray player, probably the best scenario would be to download a 4K movie like overnight, you know, and because it will take hours, even with a reasonable bandwidth into the home. But then once it's downloaded, it's on the hard disk and it can be played to the projector, no problem. So let's see. I think we have Kirk in the field next. He's going to be coming to us from Shively Labs. And what is it that they do? Let's find out.
Hey, it's Kirk Harnack live at NAB 2012, and we're in the booth of Shively Labs. Shively makes antennas, which I think are fascinating. We're with Bob Surrett. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing, Kirk?
I'm great. It's good to see you in person. Yeah. Only time I see you is at trade shows.
That's right. That's right.
Now, you are the sales and technology director? Well,
I'm director of sales engineering. I've been with the company a long time, yeah. So I kind of call myself Chief Cook and Bottle Washer.
But you're pretty good at explaining how these antennas work, and we're going to focus specifically on a very traditional design FM antenna. There's thousands of these around the world.
That's correct.
It is the Shively 6813. Can you tell our audience a little bit about how this gets a signal from a transmitter out into the atmosphere so folks can pick it up?
Well, it's fairly straightforward. Of course, we have RF coming out of a transmitter.
Right.
This particular antenna is used mostly for Class A stations.
Okay.
You know, 3 kilowatts, 6 kilowatts ERP.
Yep.
The energy goes up the transmission line.
And goes up here.
Right. And ends up on a sort of a junction right there, and which is another piece of transmission line. And attached to that at the very end is a coupling strap.
Ah, the bent metal strap there?
That's correct.
It looks like a letter D sort of?
That's correct.
Okay.
So that's our feed strap that couples the energy from the 50-ohm transmission line to the radiator.
Okay.
And the radiator couples energy to free space, which is 377 ohms.
Now, that's the... So the transmission line is 50 ohms.
Right.
Free space is, you said,
377
ohms. And so the antenna's job is to match the impedance of the transmission line to the impedance of Mother Nature.
That's correct. And I use the analogy of saying on a AC power line,
yeah,
there are transformers that take the energy from the high voltage lines to a transformer to the house current.
Yes, okay.
Okay, so this does kind of the same thing where it takes the energy from the transmitter and puts it out into free space, and then you hear it on your radio.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Now, over here you've got a bigger version of that antenna, plus it's got a big garbage can around
it. Well, in most environments, not most environments, in a lot of environments, it's good to have the elements not on the radiator itself.
Okay.
Even if, like, if you're near the ocean or water or something like
that. Yeah, you don't want salt water on it.
You don't want salt water and stuff like that. In the winter, in the north, you don't want snow and ice on it. This antenna here is our model 6810. It is a higher powered unit, and a lot of Class C stations use it.
Now, just to make sure I understand something right here, when they install this, it's not cut open like that, right?
That's there.
Okay, it's closed up.
It's all closed up.
So from a distance, these look like big gray blobs on the top of the tower.
That is correct.
Now, real quick, tell me about a couple other antennas in the booth here. There's some other designs, some that have a panel. Right. And what are these panel things?
Well, this particular one is a what we call a 6018. It's a vertical only panel.
Okay.
Actually, you can rotate it and have it so it's a horizontally
this
polarized.
This is the polarization of the wave. Okay.
Right. Okay. All of the other antennas. Well, that dipole, that vertical dipole, that does vertical only.
Okay.
In a omnidirectional sense. With a panel, if you have three around or four around, you're omnidirectional. If you have a single panel, then it's highly directional. Just above us, that's a circularly polarized panel antenna. It's just a model, if you will. Actually, the 6813, 6810, 6812, 6814, the 6020, and the 6832 over there are all full-size.
Right.
These are models.
These are miniaturized models.
That's correct. And this one here, just to give you the concept.
If folks want more information about antennas and Shively Labs, white papers, and specs,
right.
Where do they go?
Go to Shively, www.shively.com.
Okay.
And there's a for the technically inclined section in there, and you can pull that down and see several of the white papers that I've done presentations for. I believe I did the chapter on the filters and combiners for the 10th edition of the NAB handbook.
Oh, okay.
And that is also on our site.
Cool.
Yeah.
Bob, thank you very, very much.
Really appreciate
it's Kirk Harnack in the Shively Labs booth at NAB 2012.
Thanks, Kirk. Boy, you know, there's just so many different things to learn about here at the show. I don't think it can be done in 4 days, but we're certainly doing our best to bring as much of it as we can to you. Now, I've been watching the chat room here, and quite a few people have been commenting on when I was talking about 4K to the home and downloading and so on. I saw a number of people say, well, there goes your data cap, and certainly downloading a 4K file is going to do serious damage to your data cap unless you happen to have, unlimited data, which I don't think very many people do. Then there's the issue of bandwidth into the home itself, and I saw a couple of comments in there about how, the U.S. is really lagging behind the rest of the world in available bandwidth, generally speaking. I think South Korea is probably at the top at around 20 megabits, generally, on average. The U.S. is something around 6 or 7, perhaps. So that is another issue. Certainly has more to do with streaming. Although downloading, too, because at 20, it'd take you a lot less time to download a big file than at 6 or 7. So these are issues that need to be addressed, certainly in the brave new world of content. So I have here joining me now Tom Calibro, is that it?
Very good.
Excellent.
Exactly.
Wonderful. From Fujifilm and Fujinon. And I know that Fujinon is big into lenses.
We make a couple. Yeah, that's true. That is true. Yeah, we've been doing it for some time.
Mm-hmm. And the name Fujifilm, I have to say, I mean, I know the name well, but, you know, here we are in the world of digital cinema and digital photography. Where's the film?
Actually, the film is all over. First of all, with our lenses, of course, we have coatings that we have to put on our lenses to make them
that kind
transmit.
Of film.
That is one of the films that we have.
Okay.
Another film that we have is in another part of our company that there's films that we make for the front of all of these LCDs and LED monitors.
Really?
Made by Fujifilm. We are a big, big supplier of that. And in some of our other technologies which relate to film, we are in the medical business as for coatings on different medical products, medicines and what have you. So it really, when I first heard that we're keeping the name Fujifilm, I was like, well, you know, that's old school. But it's not really at all.
Yeah, exactly right. You mentioned the films that you put on the front of LCD and LED TVs. And I've noticed a trend. LCD TVs used to have this matte finish.
Right.
And now they're getting much shinier, generally speaking, which is, I think, mostly an attempt to lower the black level. Do you have anything to say about that trend?
Not so much. That is not my area of expertise. But okay. I do know that some of the coatings that we make for these monitors allow a wider viewing angle.
Ah.
So very important for, you know, for watching TV in an environment which is, you know, a normal home where you have chairs at different angles in relationship to the monitor. So it improves that.
Well, this is always the big bugaboo with all LCD TVs is as you go off axis, the contrast ratio decreases, the black level increases, it starts looking washed out. And what you're saying is that by appropriate application of advanced films, you can decrease that problem and increase the angle at which people can watch and have a satisfactory experience.
That's right. That's right. And you're very right in saying that. You know, it improves the overall contrast when you're off axis. That
right.
was a big problem in the beginning.
It
of
really
these
was.
Flat screens.
Yeah, yeah. And it still continues to be in many cases.
Yeah, but it's getting better.
Yeah,
it's getting better.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good. I'm really glad to hear that because LCD and LED TVs in particular are so far outsell plasmas, you know, that addressing that seems to be kind of one of the final issues that really needs to be addressed with LCD TVs.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
Now, do you also work in the lens part of things?
I am deeply involved in the lens part of things. I am the marketing manager and also the future product development manager for Fuji.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm constantly looking at, you know, where we're going, what we want to design, and talking with customers and bringing the right product to the market.
Now, one of the things that I think often gets overlooked with all of this talk about 4K is, you know, you can have a 4K imager, but if your lens doesn't resolve that kind of resolution, to use a mixed metaphor there,
right?
You know, then what's the point? What's the good of having a 4K imager? You really need glass that allows that much resolution to reach the imager.
That's exactly right. And that's what we work on. And that's, you know, part of our... The lens is a very complex piece of gear.
Mm-hmm.
People really don't understand it. But there are mechanics involved. There's optics involved. There's these coatings involved. A lot of physics involved. And the lenses are extremely complex. And, of course, there's also electronics involved when we get into lenses that have such devices on them.
Uh-huh. Like zoom lenses, that sort of thing?
Like zoom, like iris, like focus, like optical stabilization,
oh, yeah,
like precision
sure.
focus for automatically doing things, like a trace system where we could automatically follow a subject around a scene and the lens will actually keep that subject in focus wherever they are within
huh.
the scene.
Wow. You know, it's funny. I look at lenses very much as akin to analog electronics. Digital electronics starts expensive and gets inexpensive as you stamp out a million of them. But good analog electronics always remains expensive. As I know, glass lenses
yes.
always remain expensive because there's no way to mass produce high quality glass.
That's
it's
right.
It's so precise.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things there. As you stated, it's very difficult to make high quality glass. It's also that these devices are, for the most part, handmade.
Exactly.
A lot of labor involved in making these lenses. One of our lenses, for instance, one of our longer lenses that use on helicopters and what have you, it takes 40 man hours to produce one lens. A lot of labor. A lot of labor.
Which is why I said earlier, you know, we were talking about these 4K cameras and mm-hmm. how they're coming down and down and down in price. And oftentimes the lens is more expensive than the body.
That's right. That's right. But as I always like to say, your image is not getting any better once it leaves the back end of the lens.
That's right.
So if you want your best image, you better start out with the best lens.
That's right.
Right. Another area where the lenses have become more... A reason they become more expensive is on the image size. As the imagers have gotten smaller, 1/3 inch, you know, we've started really out in 2/3 inch, gone mm-hmm. down to 1/2 inch,
mm-hmm.
now 1/3 inch. The imager got smaller, the pixel size got smaller.
Right.
So that means the errors become easier to see. They become more apparent as you do that. Mm-hmm. So the lenses have had to become better and better and better. So that's another reason why the cost has really has stayed up, has maintained, and in some instances have actually risen.
Mm. And so what is, you know, I talked with one of your PR people before the show, and they were pretty excited about some announcements of Fujinon here at the show.
Yeah, we have a breakthrough product in the PL area. It's a PL 19 to 90, which is not all that remarkable. It's a lightweight zoom. It is the longest one available, which is nice, but if when you look at it, it looks like a standard ENG style lens because it has a servo attached to it. But in looking at it as a PL lens, it has the gearing of a PL lens. We've gone further with it in that you can actually back focus the lens rather than shimming the lens. So this is going to be a great boom to rental houses and people who are constantly changing lenses on cameras. It has a macro, which allows extreme close-ups, never before on a PL lens. But with the motor attached, it will operate like a standard ENG lens with your zoom, focus, iris. It will accept our standard ENG controllers. It will accept a wireless controller such as the Preston, controllers that the cine people are really quite used to.
Mm-hmm.
It has 16-bit encoders, so it'll output metadata, the lens data, so LDS or /I, the Cook system. So it is extremely remarkable. It is very, very well received, and it basically bridges from the cine user to the video user, and it doesn't ask either one of them to compromise. So it's actually giving both camps more than they've had ever before.
And what kind of money would we expect to spend for such a lens?
This lens is listing at $38,000 mm-hmm. with the servo.
Mm-hmm.
With the servo attached, it weighs 2.7 kilograms, without 2.2 kilograms, and has a T-stop of 2.9 flat all the way through the range.
Oh, that's nice.
And coming later this year will be its companion, and we've dubbed these the Cabrio lenses, as in cabriolet or convertible.
Mm-hmm.
Another Cabrio lens, 85 to 300.
Wow.
Will be available. And we're thinking, right now it's a little early, but we're thinking it's just going to be a little bit more expensive mm-hmm. than the 19 to 90. And we're going to start deliveries of the 19 to 90 midsummer.
Fantastic. Well, I've certainly seen Fujinon in the credits of many, many movies. So you're obviously, you know, a big name in the film industry.
That's right. That's right. And especially with our 4K plus lenses, our big PL lenses that range from 14.5 to 400 millimeters, they are really the best of the best when it comes to PL zooms. As a matter of fact, many people have told us that they are every bit as good as any prime that they've ever seen.
And the prime lens, just for those who might not know, is a single focal length.
Right, fixed focal length. Where here, for instance, we have, as I said, we started at a 14.5, but that lens is 14.5 to 45. We have an 18 to 80, and so on, all the way up to a 75 to 400.
Right. A critical link in the entire production of any visual content is the lens. And as you say, once it's through the lens, that's it. You're not going to get any better than that.
That's right. That's right. You better get your most resolution and color performance right up front.
Fantastic. Tom Calabro at Fujifilm and Fujinon, thanks so much for stopping
by. Well, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
You bet. Okay, so we've got a bunch more to show you, only about a half an hour more of live coverage here at NAB. Quite remarkable. Time flies when you're having fun. Fruit flies like a banana. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting a little punchy here. I do want to thank our other sponsor for this particular episode of live NAB coverage, which is Pond 5, which is a source of stock audio and video clips for whatever project that you may have and want to insert such things into. You know, many of you in our audience are media makers, creators of content, and you want to be able to spice that stuff up. And it may be too expensive to buy a camera or a lens or, you know, shoot your own stuff. Take a long time to do that. So why not use some stock footage, which is available to you from Pond 5? And one of the really cool things about it is you really only need to buy it once. You can use it then from then on. You own it and you can use it as much as you want. You can get music tracks, vector illustrations, sound effects, motion graphics tablets, all of which can be downloaded, and you can use it absolutely at your whim. And there's traditional stock shots from all sorts of different agencies, and you can even, if you are an artist and you want to contribute content to Pond5, you can upload to them, establish what you want to charge for the content, and work it the other way. So it really is a two-way street there. If you need content, you can get it from Pond5, and if you have content that you want to sell, you can sell it through Pond5. And Pond5 is, in fact, making a special offer for our audience members. You can get 50 stock media files to download for free if you go to pond5.com/twit. And be sure to use that that URL, pond5.com/twit, for your free 50 video clips, or media files, I should say. It could be video, could be sound, could be still images. It's all there at pond5.com. So I've been looking at the chat room here, of course, as we go along, as I always do, and I thank you all, chat room, very much. I think the Sue is in there. She met up with us during Home Theater Geeks, and I want to say hi to her especially. She followed us around for 2 hours to all the different booths that we visited, and she's a really nice gal who is a true geek, no question about it, and sure glad to have her along for the ride in the chat room along with everybody else who's in the chat room. And, you know what? Hey, Vince360 in the chat room made a very important point about Pond5. I forgot to say www.pond5.com/twit. We found out that if you don't put the www in front of it, it doesn't work. So please be sure to make a note of that, that when you go to get your 50 free media files, or to look around there on the website, you want to put that www.pond5.com in the www in front of the rest of the URL that I just gave you. I'm not quite sure why that's not working that way, but thank you so much in the chat room for pointing that out. That was very important and something that Leo, of course, caught when he was reading this, but it wasn't on my copy. So there you go, the wonders of live television. The Sue, in fact, is in the chat room saying, did I see upstairs that the military has free media files too? No, I didn't see that, actually. You know, with all this talk about 4K, and we've been talking about it all day here, and it's the talk of the show, cameras, projectors, lenses, content, everything is 4K. But probably the most important demo I've seen so far was 2K. It was actually 1920 by 1080. It was high definition, as you see at home. And it was 3D, and it was a demonstration of what's called high frame rates. Now, movies for the last 100 years have been made at a frame rate of 24 frames per second. And that was established, according to James Cameron, who was recorded and gave a little spiel in this demo, that was chosen because it was the slowest speed that would still convey a sense of continuous motion. And in those days, the studios had to pay for film stock, right? And they wanted to pay for as little as possible. They didn't want to pay for an extra foot of film stock. So they came up with, how can we get the slowest speed possible that would use the least amount of film? And according to James Cameron, the studio heads were dragged kicking and screaming to 24 frames per second. They wanted to do 16 frames per second. But the problem was that you couldn't sync audio to 16 frames per second. So that was when talkies were just coming in. And so they said, you know what, we need 24 frames per second in order to sync audio. Okay, well, that's the slowest we can go. So that's what we're going to do. Okay, fine. that's what the standard was. That's what's been shot in the U.S. for almost 100 years. Now, of course, we have digital projectors. We have digital cameras that can shoot at much higher rates and that can project at much higher rates. The digital cinema projectors, at least the more recent ones, not the very first ones, but what he called Gen 2, can project and display at higher rates, at 48 frames per second, at 60 frames per second. The cameras, the Red camera can shoot, the Alexa camera can shoot up to 120 frames per second, and the Red can shoot up to 300 frames per second. And so he is advocating that we start, that we bring the frame rate, the last piece of 20th century technology, into the 21st century. And the demonstration was in 3D on a Christie projector. It was in the Christie booth just down the hall from where I am sitting now in the lovely Twit Sky booth. And it was several clips that James Cameron had shot specifically to demonstrate the advantage of shooting at higher frame rates. And so he staged a scene of a medieval banquet, right, with people dressed in medieval clothes, very highly detailed, lots of brocade and so on. And he did several shots, what are called dolly tracking shots, where the camera is basically moved along and across this banquet table. And as it moves, there are chairs that are close in that pass by the camera, people's clothing, you know, you see it go from one side to the other. And at 24 frames per second, the objects that are in motion are quite blurry, especially the edges. And this is especially important with 3D. Because the eye, when you're looking at stereoscopic imagery, the eye is very attuned to those edges. And so at 24 frames per second, there's enough motion within each frame to cause the image of moving objects to be very blurry, especially on the edges. It's called stuttering or judder. It looks kind of ugly. So James Cameron was saying, you know, we really need to look at what happens when you increase the frame rate, the number of frames per second that are being shot. So he shot the same scene with 24 frames per second and played back at 24. He shot at 48, played back at 48, and at 60, and played back at 60. And the difference was remarkable. All this stuttery, juddery stuff simply went away. It was sharp, crisp, and clear. It was the sharpest and crispest and clearest at 60, but 48 was a significant improvement. Now, there are those who object to this and say that it doesn't look like film. And I have to say, you're right. It doesn't, because it's not film. It's removing a limitation of a standard that was established 100 years ago because of cost of film, which is no longer relevant. And so my approach to this is, I'd rather see a sharper, crisper picture of things in motion. And why we can't accept that. Some people can't accept it because they say it makes a movie look like video. I'd have to say that in a way that's probably true. But I don't care. I want the best possible picture quality. And if that means shooting at a higher rate and making it look more like video, I'm fine with that. This will engender lots of discussion and argument and so on, and that's fine. That's great. But it has to be the most important and most impressive demo I've seen at the show so far. I haven't seen the 200-inch auto-stereoscopic glasses-free 3D. I'm going to go see that after the show. But from what I've seen so far, it was just absolutely remarkable, and I really hope that Christie manages to show this demo. It's about a half an hour long. He shot a bunch of clips and showed them at these different frame rates. And I hope that a lot of people get to see it, because only then can you determine for yourself if it really is worthwhile to do that. We do know that Peter Jackson is filming The Hobbit at 48 frames per second. And we now know that James Cameron will be filming Avatar 2 also at 48 frames per second. And he also, there were, at the end of the demo, there were a couple of down conversions, right? Shot at 48 and then played at 24. Because, you know, let's face it, it's got to be backward compatible because not all theaters have the digital projectors that can play 48 frames. There are even some theaters that still have film. So it has to be backward compatible. So he showed some examples of that. And in fact, when he shot it at 48 or 60, brought it down to 24, it didn't look any worse than if it had been shot at 24 in the first place. So it is backward compatible. There's no greater degradation than you would otherwise see. And it solves that problem while also solving the problem of much sharper motion if you are fortunate enough to see it at that higher frame rate. Now, the question that I asked and some other people asked and we don't know the answer to, how will consumers know which theaters are showing it at 48 hertz or 48 frames per second? I hope that some sort of branding is done to make it clear to people. You know, the general public may not know what 48 frames per second means or you know, why it's important. But I sure as heck want to go to a theater that's showing it that way. So I'm going to be looking very carefully to see how they make that known to the world. So when The Hobbit comes out, you know that I'm going to be looking for such a theater. And living in Burbank as I do, it's likely that there'll be one there because that's actually Media Central. So that's my rant. We now have something from the field from Alex at AirJib.
This is Alex Lindsay, and I'm at AirJib XL. And now this is I have to admit, this is my kind of booth. Typically, when I do booths at shows, this is what it looks like. It's just a hole with the stuff that we have. And what they have here is a little jib here. Now, this is we've seen a lot of jibs, a lot of cranes, and this one is one of the more interesting ones. So you have your classic parallelogram. You see this here. That'll keep your camera pointed exactly in the same direction as it goes up, so it stays in there. But the thing that is a little revolutionary here that I have to say is the fact that it is built specifically to use your Coke bottle as your ballast. So, of course, you know the idea here is that you have to get the weight extrapolating for the extra distance here. There's a lot of physics here. To get the weight to actually match here, you need to have a proper weight here, and usually this is a lot more than the camera on the end. And it's always different depending on what kind of gear you have. And so, and oftentimes these are a lot of, we put weights on them, we put pennies in them, and some of us in a pinch just put Coke cans in. This is Coke bottles. I mean, there's actually openings for the bottles in here. I've just never thought of that, and I don't know why someone hasn't thought of it before this, but I thought that was kind of, you know, it's a lot of fun. Now, the question, of course, is, will we need extra bottles if this Diet Coke? I mean, that really is going to be the thing that we have to think about. But I think that, you know, we'll be able to adjust as we move forward. So anyway, this is the AirJib XL at NAB 2012.
Yeah, that's and when you're done with the jib, you can just drink the Coke. Sounds good to me. So joining me here in the fabulous Twit Skybox, high atop the South Hall at the Las Vegas Convention Center at NAB 2012, is Gabe Wardell.
Yes.
Who is with the 48-Hour Film Project. Now, this is pretty cool. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, what 48-Hour Film Project is, it's been around now for 12 years, and we're in over 100 cities around the world. People can find us at 48hourfilm.com if they want to see if there's one in a city near them.
If you can...
Oh, yes. Get closer to the mic. It's very loud in here. Mm-hmm. And so 48 Hour Film Project has been around for 12 years. And what it is it's a filmmaking competition where filmmakers are given an assignment on a Friday night. They have three obstacles that we give them, which is the name of a character, a line of dialogue, and a prop. And then all the teams will pick a genre out of a hat and then shoot, edit, write, produce every aspect of their short film between 5 and 7 minutes. In a 48-hour time span.
Holy smokes. I guess they're not planning to get any sleep in that time.
Some teams have gotten very good at figuring out how to stagger the workflow so that they can get a little bit of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we do, and what makes, I think, our program unique, is then the following week we have public shows, premieres of the films. People get to bring their cast, crew, family, friends, and so forth to see it in a theatrical environment. People vote on them. The winners go on to then compete on regional, national, and then international levels. And so it's a lot of fun.
So this is for aspiring filmmakers?
It's for anybody at any level, quite honestly, because you can be an aspiring filmmaker and just say, gosh, I want to get off my couch and finally make something. But what we actually find is the most interesting is we have a lot of commercial and professional people who like to get their crew out there and trying something a little different and new. And imagine, for example, when a guy like Steve Carell goes back to the improv stage, or when people like Amy Poehler go back to UCB. They like to keep their skills sharp, and this is really the equivalent, in our opinion, of doing that. You have to be on your game. And so even the most highly skilled filmmakers who work on commercial projects with big budgets, I'm from the Atlanta market, so we have a lot of Atlanta producers that we work with. We get people from the most competitive levels, and they've won tons of awards in the Webbies and the regional Grammys and so forth. And Emmys compete because they want to show off what they can do. They want to prove they can do it. Mm-hmm. So it's like a marathon skill set that they want to put to use.
Tex in the chat room says, my friends did this very fun contest. And Web429 asks, is it free to enter?
It is not free to enter. Okay. There's an entry fee in each city.
How much is that?
It depends on what level you enter at. So, for example, if you get in early, I think it's about $140. Mm-hmm. But if you wait till the last minute, which, again, 48-hour filmmakers tend to do, it's around $175.
Now, are there different levels? I mean, can you compete in the amateur category or the student category or the fully professional category?
It would be hard to determine going in. At this point, we have not separated them out. What we have done is we've actually done separate competitions for winners that are like more advanced, where they compete on a second tier. And we've thought about really developing that as a future project, and then also perhaps having a student-based one and so forth. But for now, we like to keep the field wide, and that way, when it comes to networking and the opportunity to get to see each other's work, people can see all different levels of skill in display at the same time.
How did the whole project get started?
Project got started, and imagine, again, 12 years ago, before technology is what it is now, by some folks in Washington, D.C., the founders Mark Rupert and Mark and Christina Rupert and Liz Langston came up with this idea. They said, could we make a film in 48 hours? Thinking at the time, there wasn't nonlinear editing systems on your laptop and cameras you can carry around in your pocket on an iPhone. And at the time, it really was a daunting task. And they decided this was a fun thing to do. They got together with some friends, and then it was off to the races. And in many respects, it was visionary because the technology has caught up with them. It's actually made it so the 48 hours is actually too much time, quite honestly.
Really?
That's where I say people can get sleep. We have in Atlanta, we have a filmmaker who works practically by himself, and he said, I was done with my project. I had around 8 hours to spare.
With 8 hours to spare?
Yeah, he actually played a street hockey game that afternoon before he dropped this final project.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is this a nonprofit organization?
No, it's a for-profit entity, and one of the things we're doing here is we're meeting a lot of the potential corporate sponsors and giving them the opportunity to, again, work with filmmakers, shooters, editors at all levels, because we think it's a great chance for them to showcase their technology and a great chance for the filmmakers themselves to try some new and interesting things.
So where can people go to get more information?
48hourfilm.com, the number 4 and 8, and then film.
Wow. It sounds fascinating and like a lot of work, but as you say, maybe for some people not so much work.
Yeah, it's a good time, and the thing that we really like to stress is just how much fun it is. And even though it's technically a competition, it really is a cooperative thing. It's kind of like a marathon. You don't run a marathon to win unless you're one of these competitive Kenyan runners.
Yeah, sure.
By and large, you're just running it to prove you can do it. And then when you finish, there's this cooperative sense of we all did this together. And in all the cities where we've been located, including New York and L.A., where it tends to be really competitive in the market, the kinds of people who do this really have amazing networking opportunities, great experiences, and they come back year after year because they had such a good time.
What other cities are you in besides New York and LA and Atlanta?
We're in Atlanta, we're in Chicago, we're in Boston, we're in Raleigh. I mean, it's, as I say, 100 cities around the world. Ho Chi Minh was one of the winners. I just did the live presentation of our best ofs up in the content theater. So, as I say, Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam. We have city Paris, France, London, England.
Wow.
We're all over the world.
Wow.
And it's just a fun project, and it's a concept that's caught on no matter where it goes.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
We love it.
That's great. Thank you so much, Gabe Wardell of the 48-Hour Film Project at 48hourfilm.com.
Correct. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it.
Okay, well, listen, we have come to very near the end of our live coverage of NAB 2012. It's been a lot of work. Some of us haven't gotten much sleep, but we have done our darndest to bring you a real sense of the show from the floor, from all these remotes that Alex and Kirk and I have been doing. As well as guests here on the stage, which we've enjoyed plenty of today, as well as the last 3 or 4 days. Leo had to take off last night to get ready for the show, his radio show this weekend, and also for his impending trip to Norway, which gives me an opportunity to fill in for him on the weekend of April 28th and 29th. Which I'll be doing from the Brick House in lovely Petaluma. Looking forward to that very much, and I hope you will join us for that. I would like very much to thank all of our staff here, because without them, we couldn't do it, and they have worked tirelessly with very little sleep in many cases. Of course, I want to thank Leo Laporte, the chief twit, for being the driving force behind all of this. He is, as somebody at the Broadcast Minds panel said, the grandfather of tech. And he certainly is a mentor to me, and I appreciate his friendship and collaboration very much. Kirk Harnack and Alex Lindsay were the other hosts along with me. We are the people you see on camera, but the people off camera are equally, if not more important, because without them, we wouldn't be on camera. Lisa Cancel, of course, is the CEO of Twit, and Eileen Rivera, the primary producer. Lynn Fu and Liz Romero have been shepherding cats and basically keeping things running smoothly. Alex Gumpel at the New Tech TriCaster, which is turning out to be a bit of a challenge, but he has handled it admirably. John Slanina has been here for much of the show, and he's the studio manager up at the Brick House, and he's been helping out on all the tech. Burke McQuinn also has been helping with the tech, as has been Jordan Nemro, Chad Johnson. Karsten Bondi has been one of the producers, as has Chad, and I've been working with him on getting many of the interviews happening here. Brent Bai, fabulous cameraman, the human Steadicam, we call him, because he's just carrying that camera all over the place with the live view when we were streaming live for Home Theater Geeks on Monday, and some other things too, I'm sure. Ryan Marsh and Daryl Nelson, we also want to thank them for their help. There's so much. Oh, and here we're gonna see a little scene of people. I hope to say hi to everybody. It's kind of dark, but yeah, we don't have all the lights on. Maybe anybody who can, come out here and let's get you on camera in the light. Come on up here. I want to say hi to everybody. Come on. Yeah, come. Come right up here. I want everyone to see all the great people who have been working so hard. Lynn Fu,
hi.
Thank you so much. Liz.
Ooh,
baby. Yeah, you guys have been just great. We thank. Come on, here's Burke.
Oh,
excellent.
Burke. Yes,
good,
Burke.
good.
Burke.
And Russell, come on, Russell. Did I say your name?
Russell.
Russell's been helping with the IT.
Yes.
And he's doing such a great job of keeping it together. Brent, bye. All right.
No.
What's that? Oh, well, you don't want to stand on this thing.
And we have Ryan.
And Ryan is behind the camera. He's actually shooting handheld. There he is right
there.
Yay! Come on, Chad. Oh, is Chad? No, Chad's not here anymore.
No,
Alex, come on in, Alex. Yeah, I know Alex doesn't like to be on camera very much, but we just want to acknowledge his great work. He's Mr. TriCaster here, and he has been just doing yeoman's duty with very little sleep, as I understand it.
Oh, and Jeff, editing. Oh, did you just fall?
I fell asleep.
Oh, he just fell asleep. Karsten, let's get you in here. I want to see Karsten.
Yes,
come on. And where's Jeff? Is Jeff...
Jeff is editing.
Wave goodbye. Karsten's last whiteboard. Here's Jeff.
Come on, Jeff.
Excellent. Jeff's been editing. I don't think I mentioned his name before either. He's not on the list I have here. He's been editing all of the segments that we have, the packages that we've been showing, and all the shows, the Live View Home Theater Geeks, and from the podcast or the Ham Nation, the Ham Party last night, in fact. We had a great dinner at Cafe Nicola. Excellent dinner with all of us last night after the party. I want to thank each and every one of you. It's been just a fabulous experience, and I look forward to doing it again next year. Yay! Actually, before next year, we will be at the CES probably again, will we not, in January? Why not? You know, maybe. We'll see. And thanks to you all in the chat room for sticking with us all this time. I just love watching the chat room chime in with all kinds of great comments and questions and answers even that nobody else has. So it's all been a fabulous experience. And with that, I guess it is time to say goodbye from NAB 2012. Bye!